all profit is value extraction. And that means that all profit is theft from you.
Corporate America is on welfare, and we've got to get them off welfare.
Last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that.
Hi, welcome to Cars and Comrades, your only socialist car podcast. My name is Bryant. Today we've got Brandon and Connor, and Zach couldn't make it today, but how are you guys doing today?
Doing okay.
Yeah.
Is this the time that I use to bitch about my fucking life right now? Is this group therapy?
It can be.
Right, we'll get there. I got fired this week.
Yeah.
No more riding my bike to work.
I mean, if there's any bright side at all, it's that you can't rub that in our face anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I mean, though.
It's okay. I'm going to move on to bigger and better things. I'm just, you know, I'm pissed off because I was laid off for the specific reason that I confronted my boss about 2 months ago and was told that that was not going to be an issue for bare minimum 6 months, but probably never. And then I was told by the general manager that more or less on a whim, he was like, actually, we're going to do this. Pull the trigger. Like, I don't think this had even a week's forethought. So, I fell into that eternal trap of I thought I had a cool boss, and at the end of the day, he was still a fucking capitalist pig.
Yep.
Damn. Fucking horseshit.
So, you know, I'm doing all the bullshit. I'm gonna just, like, look for a better job, and in the meantime, just tighten the belt up a little bit. You know, eating more beans and rice. I'm canceling all my subscription services. Just figuring out what I really want. You know, like, cancel, you know, Netflix and Hulu and, like, car insurance and stuff that, like, you don't really need.
Yeah.
Like, it's nice to have, but, like, you know, you don't really notice it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, all those luxuries, who needs it?
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to stop drinking, so I've got to, like, cut corners somewhere.
If anything, probably going to drink more now. Got more time for it.
I'm making myself not fall into that hole.
Yeah, that's smart.
That being said, I'm 4 days into this, so...
anything could happen.
Yeah, I'm going to try not to be out of work for more than another month. I'm just going to, like, really look for something that suits me.
Yeah.
Oh, and also I want to make a lot more money.
That's always good.
Hell yeah.
Good plan.
Dude, I haven't touched the drag van in, like, a year. Mm. I got to get on that.
Well, speaking of that, let's do some Project Car updates, and I guess I forgot to mention the topic of this episode. When we get to that, the main topic is going to be weird...
Nazi engines.
Yeah. Nazi Dorito spinny things. But yeah, we're going to be talking about Wankel engines, more the strange, weird Wankels that you don't hear about, not necessarily the Mazda ones, but... And, you know, we are including one designed and built in the Soviet Union. So, you know, that'll be a little treat at the end. But nice.
I just called them Nazi engines because it was only from your research, reading the notes, that I was just, like, learned that that the Wankel was designed by a fucking Nazi.
Yep.
We'll get there.
Yep. But, yeah, who wants to start first with the Project Car updates? I don't know what...
I vote for Brandon. We'll get a little continuity in there.
Yeah, there we go.
You already started. Let's go.
Yeah, I've done very little. I was working on making some parts for a buddy of mine, and I got started on some of the upholstery work for the car, but it's been slow going because I just moved everything around at home and at the shop, so I'm less making upholstered panels and doing stuff and more trying to find where I left my various supplies. Like, I would be ready to start if I could find the fucking fabric that I bought. Like, it's that level of in disarray.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've been making patterns and doing some stuff. I got to do some sheet metal forming because there is a couple of pieces of that I got to make, even for just upholstery. That seemed impossible a couple of years ago when I first was like, ah, how am I going to replace this? And now I look at it and I'm like, I could probably do that in a couple hours. So.
Fucking sweet.
You know, yeah, at least that good, like, that sense of growth. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever walked away from a project for a while and come back to it, and it just feels so much easier. But it's a really good feeling.
Yeah.
Where you're like, realize that in the interim, you've actually learned a lot and are better at the at things. I don't know. I encounter that a lot, and it's probably because I don't give myself enough credit for some of my abilities. But, you know, that being said, the only other thing is I keep fucking with the carburetor on the Ford. It's runs good now, but it doesn't like to start in the cold. Hmm. So, and it's literally as simple as to get it to start, I hold the choke shut with my hand, and it will start right the fuck up.
Yeah.
But, like, without that extra resistance. I'm wondering if, like, a spring is weak or something. I don't know, but...
It has some kind of automatic choke, you mean?
It's a thermal choke, but there's, like, a weird... Like, there should be a mechanism that holds it open, or I'm sorry, shut.
Yeah.
On startup, and then it, like, lets it relax, and it, like, opens up more based on the vacuum or thermal expansion from the exhaust, because it's, like, an archaic sort of thing. But I went back to the original style of carburetor when I bought this one. Yeah, it just, I don't know if the spring is not holding it shut well enough, or, my one working theory is that I need to adjust the float bowl height, because maybe if the fuel level is too low in the carburetor, then it has to pull more vacuum to pull that up to start siphoning it out. So maybe if I, raise the float a little bit and, raise the fuel level, then that will be gone because it will be easier for it to pull fuel into the carb. And I do have other reasons that I'm not going to get into the weeds about to think that that could be the case. Like, but I mean, like, that being said, if I can get it started, it runs fine and drives. I'm actually going to be driving in a couple of hours to pick up some furniture here in the next couple of days. And I did go to my shop to weld the one broken spot on my frame. Like, this is literally a 30-minute repair. I've done it on the side of the road at this point, but I got to my shop and the power was out, so real nuisance, but whatever.
Yeah.
And for the last week or 5 days, I guess, I've just been kind of bummed out because I lost my job that I really liked. So I'm gonna try and get back into the swing of things this week and actually like button up some projects that I now have free time for and money set aside for before I, you know, go and get another job. So that's me. I'm just going to keep it at that. Fuck bosses, fuck capitalism. But at least I got a little bit of free time now.
Yeah.
Always remember that no owner has your back.
Right.
No. Not ever. I mean, it kind of sucks because, like, what the fuck are you going to do, though? You know what I mean? You're like, okay, well, this is the information I have available to me. If they're lying, well, okay. What are you going to do
about
it?
I'll say that if I would have not given my boss as much credit as I did, I would have learned what car he drove.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna expand on that. Just I would have not learned to recognize his car in a parking lot.
Yeah.
But that's me. I did nothing big, and hopefully I'm gonna get some stuff done. I actually might do the trans swap on my Cutlass this week.
Nice.
Because I made a free time and I have 90% of the parts I need. So, yeah. Connor, what have you been up to?
Not terribly too much. The Z is waiting for the steering angle kit to go in. So, I bought that off somebody a while back with the intention of putting it in come springtime. Probably should have been working on this a little bit sooner, but I do got to get that in, and part of the reason is because I have to... The wheels I can run on the car are going to be dependent on how much space and clearance I actually have with this steering angle kit. And unfortunately, the manufacturer... I think I've gone into this a little bit. The manufacturer of the kit recommends a size of wheel that kind of just sucks. They recommend like 18 by 9 plus 10 offset. And the problem with that is that it doesn't have a, it's not like a low enough offset that the wheel will actually look good. It looks kind of silly. With like, if you get wheels with like a dish to them, it's not as nice, right? It's, if you're going to have a wheel that's got some dish to it, you kind of need like a good 2 to 3 inches at least. If you're running a 1-inch lip, it's just not as, fewer style points, you know what I mean? And if I'm spending the kind of money I'm going to be spending on wheels, I'm going to get either wheels that look good, you know, without a lip, or I'm going to get wheels that actually can have some lip to them. So, but unfortunately, the manufacturer recommends a very conservative size that, you know, they're being conservative. You just don't know how conservative they're being. So without putting the kit on, I have no way of knowing what actually will fit. So there's some imperative to actually get this kit on sooner rather than later. And then what I'm going to do is, because apparently no one will let you test fit wheels or anything, which is a big pain in the ass, but, you know, the people that, like, sell the wheels, they're like, well, you know, there's nothing we could do. I'm like, you're wheel experts. Come on, man. Especially, like, they're a drift shop, too. And I'm like, I know you have seen this car come with this kit through this fucking shop. What wheels fit? Can you tell? They just won't admit to anything. And so I'm like, all right, fine, I'll do it myself. So what we're doing is, I found a wheel measurement tool on the interwebs, and it's a tool that has a plate that fits onto, you know, multiple lug patterns, whatever, but it'll fit onto your hub. And then it's got, like, these tracks that mount inside of a tire, right? So I bought some new tires because I'm going to, you know, I drift. I'm going to need them at some point anyway. So I got tires that are, like, 265 millimeter wide, which should fit on, like, a 9 to a 10-inch wheel or whatever with a little stretch. Whatever the case may be, that tire will be able to, like, well, I'll be able to turn it in as once the kit is on and actually see where the clearance issues come in, right? So if I know that, like, because I can just change the backspacing. So, like, if I push it all the way in and the tire is contacting the control arm, I know I have to pull it out a little bit. And then that's where, like, you change that offset based on where you actually have clearance. And then, of course, you have to, like, you have to guess at the safety factor. But, like, I don't know, it's probably an inch or two or something, because obviously
things safety flex- third, baby.
Well, you know, obviously there's some flex in your suspension under load, so you want to be kind of careful. Like, I don't want to have, like, a half inch of clearance not under load, and then as soon as I go drifting, fucking hit some shit that I'm not supposed to. That's not good. But honestly, so it's just going to come down to actually getting the kit on, testing it out with this, you know, this wheel measurement tool, which I'll let you all know how it works, because I've never used a tool like this before. I didn't even know it was made, but kind of makes sense when you think about it. But hopefully it'll be able to tell me that, like, okay, I can run a slightly more favorable wheel size. And then as soon as I do, I know what size I can run, I'll turn around and order them. But
that's cool.
Yeah. So the tool was like, I think it was like $100. So, like, yeah, it's more than I want to spend for, like, needing it one fucking time. But when I'm going to spend, I don't know what it is, like $2,500 or more on wheels, you know what? Spending $100 to make sure that they actually are going to fit right is kind of important. Because I can't just return them. They're custom wheels. You can't.
Yeah.
You know, and they come from Japan. Like, you can't. There's no. Fuck. Yeah, there's no. There. I'm going to be waiting 3 or 4 months for these.
You're not going to get them overnighted?
Yeah. yeah, so it's. It's a whole thing, but that's why I'm kind of just trying to be safe with that. So,
hey, and then on the bright side, once I get all the suspension done for my car, you can mail that to me so that I can use it. Help out a buddy.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
I'm sure it'll be way easier to find fitment for my car, but, like, I still would like the maximum amount of wheel, because I want to upgrade to 17s on mine, like, and
I think the one I have, like, yeah, actually, you can test it. You can change between 17, 18, 19-inch wheels, whatever. It's a nifty little thing. So, yeah, I'll actually send that to you, because I would like for it to get some
I
use.
Saw a video on, like, Instagram or something one time where somebody had something that is what I assume you're describing, where they were able to, like, mess with
all the
different adjustments to.
There are similar things that are a little more simple. Like, they'll pretty much check, like, where it is relative to, like, your fender. Whereas this actually, because it mounts inside the tire, I can check the clearance to my control arms and shit, which is not usually a big deal for most cars. Like, you don't really need that unless you're doing serious modifications for, like, steering angle and shit. Like, that's where it gets funky.
I will be doing that, but it's with a pretty well-established kit that I've never heard of any clearance issues with.
So, Connor, is this thing, it replaces the wheel with an adjustable thing? Is that what you're saying? And you have the tire on there?
Yeah. Yeah. So you take your wheel off, and then you mount this thing onto the hub, and you I don't know what order you do it. If you, like, set it up inside the tire first, or if you put the plate on to the hub and then put the tire on, whatever it is. But it simulates the tire that you plan on using in that space.
The wheel?
So you can check the clearance. And, like, obviously, if you need to change what offset you're using, it'll let you know where that point is. So.
Okay. Yeah, because I think I had mentioned, you know, a few months ago, I need to do the sort of the opposite version of that. And I have the Saturn wheels that I want to put on my Toyota, and I need to make a mock-up of the tire to figure out which tire I can do. And actually, I'll show you guys. I've got it. This is the template that I cut out. I used, like, one of those, I've got it. It's a contour gauge.
Profile gauge or something?
Yeah, I used a contour gauge to map out the inside of the wheel, like with the lip and everything. And then I need I need to draw on here the profile of the tire and put it up on the wheel with, like, some duct tape and then bolt that to the car and see where, you know, if it has enough clearance to run whatever size tire I need. But that's kind of what I'm working with, is cardboard aided design right now.
80% of fabrication is cardboard. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so I've got that. So hopefully in the next couple weeks, my mechanic said he's a little bit busy. I did have that drift shop quote me on installing the angle kit, and price was higher than I wanted to pay. I was like, I don't know. I think I'll go to my usual guy who's pretty good at this stuff. Unfortunately, he doesn't have an alignment rack, so I will still have to go to them probably for the alignment. But I was like, I saw the price. I was like, all right, I'll pay it. But then I saw the, like, add 2 hours for the upper if you have upper control arms too. And I'm like, well, okay, hold on. Now this is not reasonable anymore. I was like, no, come on. I'm like, I have removed the upper control arms in less time. Like, no thanks. So yeah, it is what it is. But that's kind of what's coming up for the Z. For the Camaro, I'm getting pretty close to done, ready to sell. I dropped it off yesterday at a detailing shop, so it's going to have a full detail. Hopefully it will look nice enough for someone to want to buy it. And then it is getting its gas tank replaced and then off to the vinyl shop to get the stripes replaced. And then I think that car is fucking sellable. So, like, weeks away, theoretically, possibly, maybe, but weeks away.
Nice.
I just can't help but think about, like, the meme that's like, spend $10,000 so that you can sell your car for $5,000.
Right.
That is where I'm at. No bullshit. The thing being, I have spent the money over, like, 12 years. So honestly, if I get like 60% of it back at once, oh man, that's fucking excellent.
It only sucks because it's a car that you hate. Like,
it's, yeah,
it's getting 60% back on a car that, like, you've had your fun with and it's just time to move on. That's, yeah, that 40% that you ate was just because, yeah, you liked the car. You
enjoyed
fun
it.
With it. You drove the shit out of it. I've never heard you say a fucking positive word about that Camaro.
No, there was a time where it was okay, but it broke so many times that it was like, it was a little bit of fun when I was young and before I knew what a good car felt like. So, you know, it was cool when I was ignorant. Now that I'm no longer ignorant, I hate that car.
I mean, I think I've had my Cutlass for 4 or 5 years, and I've only actually learned to love it in the last, like, 6 months, because that's how long it has been reliable enough that I could have fun and beat on it.
Yeah.
So, like, I fully understand where you're coming from. Just in sort of the inverse way. Like,
yeah.
I finally got the bugs that haunted me sorted out, and now I actually, it took me probably 2 or 3 months of driving it just to get to the point where I wasn't, like, all puckered up the whole fucking time just waiting for the next problem. But now every time there's a next problem, it's something really simple and I actually just get to enjoy the car and it's great. But for 4 years or more, I wouldn't drive it for months at a time because it was just fucking fail.
Yeah. But anyway, that's all I got. So,
all right, Bryant, that's you.
Yeah. So what have I been doing? So I think last time we left off, I was talking about getting a new tune for my Sabaru, because I suspect that the last tune I had was done when it had a vacuum leak. And And it hasn't been running 100% since I've like fixed that and, you know, fixed another few things with the car. So now that I think I have mostly everything fixed, I think I want to do a proper tune. And so I talked to the tuner that Zach recommended that helped him out with his WRX. And he suggested, you know, let's make doubly sure that you don't have any vacuum leaks. Let's do a boost pressure test, which is where you basically pump up the intake side of the engine with pressurized air and just check for any leaks. And I did a couple things. First, I did a smoke test, and I used the like pump for like pumping up a like a yoga ball that came with it. And I made this, well, I made this thing a while ago that's soldering iron in a jar full of baby oil, or, you know, with a little bit of baby oil at the bottom, just where it touches the heating element. And so basically it heats up and it makes smoke out of that baby oil, and then it sucks it through the hose into that pump, and then you can pump up the intake. But that wasn't making a whole lot of smoke, so I did what someone else suggested, and I got a $1 cheap cigar at the liquor store and put that in the intake side of the pump, and that produced a lot of smoke. It also made my garage smell like cheap cigars.
Like, it'll make the whole engine stink.
Yeah. Like all the best garages smell like.
Yeah. And also, like, after I was finished, like, the whole inside of that pump was, like, full of tar. So
yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if that's great for inside the engine.
Right. So I found, mostly I just found that, like, there's all these vacuum hoses that you have to plug to make it work, because I was, like, getting smoke coming out of the oil fill cap. You know what I mean? Because it was going through the PCV system into the crankcase and out the oil fill, which makes me think also I should probably replace my PCV, you know, one-way check valve. So I ordered another one of those. It's kind of a chore to put on, to change out on a Subaru, but I'll do that eventually. But, and then I moved on from that to doing like a pressure test. And the only compressor I have is this little, like, 12-volt cigarette lighter thing that is, like, for pumping up tires in your car, you know, like, if you're on the side of the road. And it works fine for that, but there's enough leaks, you know, past the rings and the valves and whatnot that it's not able to keep up. So I was only able to get up to about 15 PSI of pressure in the intake, and then it would just all leak out. So I need to go and buy a compressor. And I was hanging out with some friends yesterday, and a friend of a friend that I hadn't met before is like, oh, I've got an extra compressor I'll sell you for like $40. And it's not in the greatest shape, but it'll work. I'm like, all right, sweet. I don't need one that's in the greatest shape, and $40
sounds like. Yeah, problem solved.
So actually, I just saw a notification. He popped up with a message just as we were talking, saying, hey, do you want me to drop that off? So I will figure that out when we're done talking here. But yeah, that's about where I'm at with that. Like I said, I need to figure out the tire fitment for my MR2 and get working on that. But I did confirm that I need to get my Sabaru emissions tested first. And I'm hoping that with the tune and everything working properly, it'll pass emissions just as it is. But if I need to, I can swap out the for the stock catalytic converter rather than the high flow one, and just, you know, that'll probably pass no problem. But I got some high temp RTV, so I'm not gonna get carbon monoxide poisoning again from when I did that 2 years ago. What else have I been doing? Oh, and I fixed my computer yesterday. So I'm not sure what it was making some noise. And I was like, that sounds like it could be the hard drive. So I just went out and got another hard drive and, you know, cloned I forget what software I used. I think it was called Macrium Reflect. It's like a free software you can use to just clone one hard drive onto another. So now it's working. It's not making that noise anymore. Also, I think one of the wires inside was rubbing against a fan. So I just, you know, moved that out of the way, made sure it was had some clearance, and cleaned all the dust out of it. So that probably
you're currently reminding me that my computer is half taken apart, and I'm just using it as is with, like, the panels off and, like, drives not fully, like, mounted and shit.
Yeah.
Because I just...
That's fine.
I did some upgrades and just haven't, like, fully put it back together yet.
I mean, my computer, I had to put a bigger fan on it, and it didn't fit in the case. So I just cut a hole and patched it up with some cardboard and duct tape. So...
You guys are treating your computers like they're your cars.
Yeah.
Which I respect. Mad respect.
I mean, my computer actually has, like, a lot of expensive, nice components on it, and I just treat it badly. So, yes, that is 100% correct.
Did you see that thing? I think I posted it in our group chat a while ago that was, like, this guy had some kind of V8 engine. I think it was, a Chevy Big Block that had, like, a bunch of, like, clear plastic, like, on the valve covers and, like, the coolant hose or whatever was like a clear section of pipe, and
I've seen that before. There actually were companies that made just so those were like regular valve covers, but they had like they were windowed and had clear plastic in place. There were companies in the 70s, I think, who did just entirely plastic valve covers, so that you could just see super cool, but like I can't imagine that it like looked good after the engine ran for 30 seconds,
right?
But. I actually liked what that guy did way better.
Yeah. And the caption on that one was, this guy's treating his engine like a gaming PC.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's all I've been up to. We'll see what I do in the future with that Subaru. If it, you know, I have been, we were talking about, like, earlier before we started recording, like, you know, Brandon, you're talking about getting, like, a practical modern car, and I'm like, I should just get a hybrid, you know. Like,
don't tell our listeners I was talking about.
I'm sorry, I don't want to ruin your reputation.
Uh-oh.
In my defense,
okay, we're probably gonna have to cut this out.
I'm trying to get a job, or I'm looking into some jobs that are further away and pay like so much more money that my car payment would be made up for in 1 week of the month.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, if I can make up for my entire car payment in like by like the end of the first Friday of the month, then. Yeah, maybe I'll buy something reasonable so that I can drive 45 minutes to work. Am I happy about the idea? No, but...
Worth maybe $6,000 with a, like, 10-year-old car that's worth maybe $10,000. So, like, it's not... Yeah, I'm not going to have a car payment, I don't think, but... I don't know, we'll see. Well, shit, did we cover everything in, like, less than an hour? Should we move on to the main topic here, or should we take a break?
I'm good to go. I took a break.
Okay.
When you think about it.
Cool. Well, we can move into the Wanko engine. Let me pull up my notes here. Jamie, pull that up. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the Wankel engine, and I'm going to say Wankel, not Wankel, or whatever the proper German pronunciation is.
It's spelled with a W.
Yeah.
It's Wankel. Yeah. What do you mean?
Yeah, well, the inventor sounded like a real fucking Wankel.
Yeah.
And, you know, agreed. Originally I was going to combine this with the Offenhauser engine and name the episode Wankel and Offie. Just because I thought that was funny, but we had to
go so deep into the Offenhauser.
Yeah, I mean,
still such a cool motor.
Yeah,
very cool.
And the more I looked into this, there was more weird Wankel engines, and I could have like even picked a couple more, but I'm gonna concentrate on the three weirdest that I can think of.
And nothing weird about the Offie motor; it was just an absolute fucking unit.
Yeah. But before we get onto the engine, I just did want to talk a little bit about Felix Wankel himself, the guy that invented it, although there is maybe some question about that. So he was born August 13th, 1902 in Lahore. So he went to high schools in a name that I'm not sure I can pronounce.
I'm looking at these notes and I was like, Brian, you are very ambitious if you think you're going to be pronouncing a lot of this stuff here.
Donishingen, Heidelberg, I know that one, and Weinheim. But then he left school in 1921. He had a diploma, but not, he didn't take the college entry exam. So he didn't go to college, even though he was later got a honorary doctorate. So that's why some people called him Dr. Wankel. Not a real doctor.
So why did he get the, do we know why he got the honorary doctorate?
I mean, it's same reason why any famous person gets an honorary doctorate, is just like some university is like, you seem like a cool guy. Here's a piece of paper that says we think you're cool.
Okay.
And,
got
it. You know, accomplish something. So he worked at a publishing company until 1926. And during this time, he was working with some friends at a machine shop and motorcycle repair garage. And then, you know, in 1926, he made that his full-time job. And in 1924, he first conceived of the idea of the Wankel engine, but as a compressor. So just like an air compressor or a supercharger. And he patented the idea as an engine in 1934. So also during the 1920s, Wankel was a member of various anti-Semitic organizations. And in 1922, he became a member of the NSDAP, a.k.a. the National Socialist German Workers Party, a.k.a. the Nazis. So dude was a straight-up Nazi. Like,
yeah, he was an early believer.
Yep, got in on the ground floor, basically.
Yeah, he sounded like he was real about it.
Yeah. So,
like, all those people that you can say, like, well, you know, they were just kind of going with the flow, you know, they're in the 30s, they kind of got wrapped up in it. No, this dude was an early advocate.
Yeah, this guy was just like, what, Jews? Yeah, I hate them. And you're like, oh, all right, very weird. Very weird.
Yeah. So this was, like, the year before the beer hall putsch is when he joined the Nazi party.
Jesus Christ.
Which, actually, like, now that I think about it, it's like, so, I mean, Europe had a real big anti-Semitism problem, but to, like, go the next step to, like, the Nazi party is, like, oof, that's weird even for Europe. Jesus.
Yeah. And, I mean, he was...
I mean, if you want to see how it gets ramped up like that,
you
have an ongoing live example in current history.
Right.
Yeah.
He became a leader in the Hitler Youth in 1931. So basically he was like the local scout leader of the Hitler Youth. He was like that guy in Jojo Rabbit with the cape or whatever. But so he got in an argument with the local Nazi leader, Robert Heinrich Wagner or Wagner. And I forgot what the argument was about, but it was something really stupid. But it ended up with Wankel being expelled from the party in 1932. So he went and started his own National Socialist splinter group that was inspired by the Strassreit wing of the Nazis. That was like, you know, well, you're not going to let me be in the Nazi party. I'm going to start my own Nazi party.
Wow. So he was like extra super Nazi at that point.
Yeah. And
cool. Very cool.
So the regular Nazi party didn't really appreciate this. And when they came to power in 1933, they had him arrested. And it was only by the intervention of Hitler's economic advisor, Wilhelm Kepler, and Hitler himself that Wankel was set free. So, he was in prison for a few months in 1933.
I was going to say something about how when even the worst person you know makes a good point, and then Hitler himself intervenes to save this guy's ass. Right. So he just keeps getting worse.
Yeah, no, there's no good people in this situation. They all suck. So Wankel applied to rejoin the Nazi party in 1937, but was rejected. But then with the help of Kepler, he was readmitted and made a member of the SS. in 1940 with the rank of, let's see if I can pronounce this, Obersturmbannführer. And then in 1942, his membership was revoked for unknown reasons. So this guy was just too much of a dick to get along with other Nazis.
Oof. God, yeah, that's real piece of shit.
Yep.
Unfathomable evil.
Yeah, I don't know, like, how... I mean, he was definitely an anti-Semite, so he's definitely evil in that regard. I don't know if he was just a, you know, a mean son of a bitch that was hard to get along with or what, but...
I kind of don't care.
Yeah.
Fuck him.
Yeah, you know what? He's dead. I'll get to that, but, you know, I'll tell you where his grave is. You can go piss on it if you want.
There has been no detail that you have submitted in this story that makes me want to, like, give him the benefit of the doubt anyway, so...
And, yeah, and sorry if I gave that impression that I was defending him at all.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm just really doubling down on fuck this guy.
Yeah, okay, good. Let's see, so during World War II, he developed... seals, like, you know, rotary seals, like, for shafts and engines and whatnot, for the German Air Force and Navy torpedoes, as he also worked for BMW and Daimler-Benz. And then after the war, the region that he lived in was occupied by France, and he was imprisoned by French authorities for several months, and his laboratory was closed and occupied by French forces. And also his all his notes and work were confiscated by the French during this time. However, in 1951, he got some funding to, you know, set up a new lab and work for NSU, which made mostly motorcycles and also some small cars. You know, so I don't know if the world would have been a better place if this guy died in a French prison, but I'm going to hazard a guess and say yes.
Yeah, probably.
But so this was in 1951. He started working on the Wankel engine design again. It took him until 1957 to get his first running prototype. And this was different than the modern design because it had both the rotor and the housing were rotating. And I don't quite understand how this worked exactly or why. But there was another engineer working at NSU named Hans-Dieter Paschke. I'm not sure how I pronounce it. P-A-S-C-H-K-E. That's too many consonants in a row for my American brain to understand. So this guy worked on refining the design, and he's like, hey, what if we had the housing fixed and only the rotor moving? Which is, you know, how...
What did Wankel have to say about this? What did this notoriously open-minded and friendly guy have to say?
You have turned my racehorse into a plowmare.
Fucking asshole.
So, maybe we should, instead of calling this the Wankel engine, we should call it the Paschke engine, if we can pronounce that.
Yeah, because that's... I vote for that.
Yeah, because it's the actual design that's used, you know, in modern cars. Well, some...
Yeah, I also, like, I don't understand, like, if the housing and the rotor both moved, how did you mount the fucking thing anywhere?
It had, like, a rotor, a housing inside of a housing. So it was, like, the fixed part and then another part that rotated and then the rotor inside that rotated. So it was, like, wheels inside of wheels kind of thing.
Yeah, unnecessarily complicated.
Right. It probably had something to do with the porting and the timing and all that, but...
I mean, he was German, so over-engineering this was probably very intuitive for him.
Hmm.
And so NSU came out with the first rotary-powered production car. I think it was called the Prince. I think it was a single rotor, like around 600cc, made around like... I don't know why I don't have this in my notes, but it was... Yeah, it was like around 50 or 60 horsepower. And so this... You know, a lot of people started getting interested in this, and, you know... There are different companies that were licensing the design and experimenting with it. But back to Felix Wankel for a second. He never got a driver's license himself because he was extremely nearsighted. But he did get a NSU RO80 with a Wankel engine and it had a chauffeur driving around in it. And in 1969, he was granted an honorary doctorate of engineering from the Technical University of Munich. He was known for his championing of animal rights and opposition to the use of animals in testing.
God fucking damn it. What is it with fucking Nazis and animal rights?
Right, but like...
Is that a, wait, is that a thing?
Well, Hitler was vegetarian, like, famously. And I'm just,
I actually didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, I don't know the reasoning.
Very extra weird when you think about how they advocated for treating groups of humans.
Right, exactly.
Very oh, yeah, 100%. Fucking crazy.
Like, when you're advocating for the rights of animals, but then you're trying to diminish humans to the level of animals and then give them no, like...
That's so gross. I mean, obviously it's all
risky arguments to even dip your toes into in that, but just on the whole, it's an absolutely batshit position to take.
Right.
Yeah. Huh, crazy.
It's like, you know, it's like being like the Dalai Lama, but also having slaves. It's just a wild thing to do.
Yeah, I was like, I could see this coming. As soon as you said Dalai Lama, I was like, all right, where is it? And they were really mad about the Chinese communists taking away the slaves. Yeah. So they made a fuss
slaves,
about it,
wasn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
More, yeah. I think. Yeah, it was most of the population, or not most of it, but a significant portion of this population was serving the, you know,
yeah, but
religious, what do you call that?
The Lamas.
Kind of the religious class. Yeah.
Well, the Dalai Lama himself had more slaves personally than George Washington.
So. Yeah.
Wasn't going to say. So
communists are real good at getting rid of slaves.
And capitalists are,
you know,
real,
taking away slaves.
Capitalists are real bad at ever forgiving them for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see. So Wenckel died in Heidelberg in October 1988, age 86. Only the good die young.
Yeah, god damn. That is, I almost would rather not know that.
Yeah.
And his...
I'm going to start assuming that anyone who lives too long is probably evil.
Well,
that's actually dumb. I should.
I was gonna say my grandparents are pretty old and they seem cool, but yeah. Maybe there's something I don't know.
What were they doing in like 1939?
They were teenagers.
That's a joke. You don't have to engage.
Let's see what I was gonna say. So Wenckel's grave is in the Burgfriedhof graveyard in Heidelberg. If you want to go piss on that.
Yeah, next on your next trip to Germany, seriously, you should just make a stop at this guy's grave.
Yeah.
Gender neutral bathroom.
Maybe pour some 2-stroke oil on it just for fun. let's see. So we haven't really gotten into the design of the Wenckel engine, and this is kind of hard to describe. So I'll put in the show notes a link to a video how rotary engines work by the channel Engineering Explained. Yeah, and that will sort of give you more of a visual, or you can look at like the Wikipedia page has illustrations. The best of my ability, I'll try to describe it. You have an oval housing, and then a sort of triangular rotor that fits inside of that. And there's a bunch of fancy math words for this. The housing's inner side resembles a 2-lobes oval-like epitroidal, whereas the rotary piston has 3 vertices, trochoid shape.
Yeah, so I think that's what that's saying is essentially the housing looks kind of like a peanut.
Yeah.
Right? You've almost got two... It's like an oval, but like there's 2 clear lobes, and it like kind of is cinched in the middle. And then the triangular piece isn't exactly a triangle because each of the ends are bowed out.
Yes.
So it's sort of, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's triangular-ish, and then this they're bowed a little bit. So then as it rotates around so like the center has like kind of a big hole in it. So it actually like moves around laterally inside the rotor housing, right? So that's how it fills out this like weird peanut shape, is because obviously that triangular piece shifts around as it rotates. It shifts kind of left to right to fill out these like other lobes, Which is, yeah, it's I'm realizing now that this is a really hard thing to explain in an audio format. But
if you can listen to a podcast, you can look it up on YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean, basically what it means is instead of pistons and cylinders, you have this rotor and housing that makes three different chambers at any given time. And by the way that the rotor moves, it either increases or decreases the volume of those chambers. So similar to like a piston going up and down in a cylinder. And so you you have ports around the outside where it draws in fresh mixture, then it compresses it, then a spark ignites it, then it expands to do work, and then it pushes out the burned mixture through an exhaust port. And you have, you know, some of the difficulty comes from you have all these seals on the rotor to make it actually not leak, you know, compression, but those are all sliding and at different angles, and they all have to be oiled. So like usually you either pre-mix some oil in the fuel, like in a two-stroke engine, or like the later Mazda ones would have like a little pump that would meter enough oil into the intake to lubricate everything. But what a lot of companies found out researching this is that, you know, depending on RPM, a lot you'd get like a harmonic vibration, and those seals, especially on the apices or on the apex of the rotor, the corners of the triangle, would like resonate and shatter in the housing, and wear out prematurely.
I actually didn't know, that would be like affected by a particular frequency.
Yeah, I mean it's basically just like a spring and a mass, you know, oscillating without a damper. So, like, other than, you know, just whatever oil and whatever gas in there acting as a damper. But, like, I mean, Mazda spent, you know, decades basically refining this to make it work in a, you know, practical way on the RX7, RX8, or RX whatever. They made a few different, you know, models over the years. And they got it, you know, working pretty good, but still, like, most rotary engines, like, last around 60,000 miles, I want to say, before they need a rebuild. Maybe 120 if you're lucky. So
yeah, if you're lucky.
That's why a lot of people are, like, buying old, shitty RX-8s and motor-swapping them with LS motors.
Yeah, I feel like there are more people who are willing to keep the rotary in the RX-7 FC, well, actually not even the FC, everybody swaps them out. FDs are more likely to keep their rotary engine. The RX-8s, I think people just ripped them out. Nobody gave a shit because they weren't turbo.
Right.
The turbo ones people kept because they were pretty cool. They actually did have some merit. They were still not super reliable, but they were a lot better.
And I mean, I'll get into some of the advantages and disadvantages here in a second, but, like, you know, rotary engines work really well with turbos because by their geometry, they're low compression, and also they have a lot of exhaust gas velocity because that port is open. You know, it's not like a valve that opens gradually. It's just, whoop, there's an open port there, and all the exhaust is going out. And you also, by its nature, it doesn't burn its mixture 100%, so you can get like very hot burning exhaust gases going right into the turbo and spool it up pretty quick. At least that's my understanding. I'm not 100% sure on the physics of all this stuff.
Yeah, I assume that like the exhaust port probably just stays open because really it's like the combustion chamber is moving, not so much the valves.
Right.
It's like, oh, once it moves to this quadrant, now it's drawing air in as it rotates. And then in the next one, it starts to compress it. Then in the next one, it starts to expand. Obviously, it sparked it. And then once it gets to the exhaust stroke, so it's like, it's four strokes of an engine in four lobes of this housing where it's moving. So then once the combustion chamber moves to the exhaust one, they just, I assume, leave that port open. And once that apex seal crosses it, you're just pushing the exhaust gas into it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right.
There's no, that's why there's no gradual opening of a valve, is because the same job that is done by the valves moving in a regular engine is done by the rotor moving in this engine.
Right.
I fucking hate rotaries.
Yeah.
I kind of like them. I kind of like I would do it if I had an FDRX7. I would do that if it had a big giant fucking turbo on it and whatever, but that is probably the only place I would deal with one.
If I had unlimited money and I could never die and just completely ran out of things to do in life, maybe I would fuck with a rotary.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be like if I won the lotto, I might have an RX-7 or something, or an RX-8. Actually, if I had an RX-8, it would probably have a motor swapped in. But yeah.
Yeah, I would swap that.
So some of the advantages of a rotary engine is you get a really good power-to-weight ratio. So, like, just the physical size of the engine is a lot smaller than a piston engine, and you can make it a lot lighter, and they make pretty good power. So, like an FDRX7 makes over 300 horsepower, I think, stock, and, you know.
I think stock. It was, like, I think it was lower. It was, like, I think it was, like, 257
I think
or something,
officially it was.
It's a light car.
I think officially it was 275 or 276, whatever the official, like, gentleman's agreement was.
I thought it was below that gentleman's agreement. I'm pretty sure it was lower, okay. But it was a lighter car.
Yeah.
It was the lightest of the bunch.
It was, yeah, it was like 2,300 pounds or something like that, right?
Yeah, they were very light because this engine is so fucking small.
And that engine technically is a 1.3 liter, although depending on how you classify the displacement, it could be twice that, I think, because...
Oh, I guess I didn't know. I guess I never really asked how they measure the displacement on this.
Yeah, so like basically it depends on how you count revolutions. So the rotor moves slower than the output shaft of the engine, I think by either half or a third. So like you might get like 9,000 RPM on the tack because that's how fast the output shaft of the engine is spinning, but the rotors are actually moving 4,500 RPM or whatever it is.
Oh, okay.
And so I think they count the displacement on revolutions of the rotor, not the crankshaft.
That's so, yeah. Like, again, it's messing with my brain to be like, you calculated the volume of something based on how fast it was moving?
Like, well, I mean, like a...
I'm confused there.
Like a gas motor, like a piston engine motor... That you're calculating the displacement per revolution, right? Generally speaking?
No.
I didn't think
it would
think
be the
were.
Displacement per two revolutions.
Okay, yeah.
Well, because you're just taking the displacement of all the cylinders, which would have a power stroke every two revolutions, right?
But, I mean, like, really, like, that's never, in any other way I've ever heard explained, been framed that way, because, like, a two-stroke motor, if it's... 100 cc's, that's still because the cylinder, like, the cylinder, hypothetical cylinder created by the diameter of the piston and the up and down movement of it,
yeah,
is the displacement of the motor. I see where that gets complicated with one of these motors because it is not creating any easily calculable,
yeah,
like, displacement like that. But
I mean, to me, I would think of it. And this is stupid. And again, this isn't the correct way, but I don't know. And maybe it is. I have no idea. I'm ignorant. I'm gonna say something probably ignorant, but I would think that in a regular engine, you're measuring the cylinders, right? This cylinder is this size. It has this volume, and there's four strokes that happen within this cylinder, one of which is a power stroke. I would assume that the same four strokes exist in a rotary, right?
Yeah.
So compartment one, if that's 1.3 liters, that would make sense because then it moves to the next quadrant. It's still 1.3 liters, moves to the next one. It's still, but it's got every stroke is like its own cylinder in a way, but really it's just one cylinder. So I would think that the displacement would be the volume of the max volume of each of those quadrants or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that's like the chamber. But I guess that's weird if, yeah, I don't know. That seems really weird. Again, to me, displacement is volume.
I mean...
That's what I think it should
so
be.
So, like, any engine is basically a pump, right? And I think what they're trying to see is, like, how much does it pump per revolution, and what counts as one revolution is where the distinction lies. So, like, depending on what country it is, some of them counted this displacement, like, for tax purposes as one way or the other.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I guess that makes... I guess I could see it.
I see both arguments. I have no opinion. It does not seem straightforward.
Yeah, it's very weird.
Just another reason for me to hate rotaries.
So, if you have a single rotor engine, it's about as smooth as a three-cylinder engine because you've got three chambers. But more often, they're done in two-rotor configuration so that the up and down of each rotor cancels each other out as far as the vibrations and balance and all that. And then that, you have six chambers, so it's about as smooth as like a inline six engine. And you don't get like the same, like, I think they call it second order vibrations of like the conrod moving back and forth. So they're much easier to balance and they're much smoother than an equivalent piston engine. And like I said, because of the smaller size, it's easier to package. They're able to reach higher revolutions, engine speeds than piston engines. So like, RX-8s, I think, or RX-7s redline around like 8,000 or 9,000 RPM or something like that.
Yeah, they're about 9,000, I think.
Yeah.
I think the RX-8 was like a little bit less, if I'm not mistaken. It was like 8,600 or something.
That sounds right, yeah.
And that's, you're just like, if you took away the turbo and lowered the engine RPM, fuck you. That's why nobody liked those, but...
They're also not prone to engine knocking, which I think has more to do with, like, the combustion chamber shape. And in theory, they're cheaper to mass produce because the engine has fewer moving parts. Although, as we talked about with, Mazda had a hell of a time figuring out the chatter caused by those apex seals and actually making them, durable. So cheaper to make, but more expensive to engineer, maybe.
It doesn't feel cheaper when you're on your third one at 100,000 miles.
Right, exactly.
Say, I'm like, yeah, it was cheaper to make, but you had to fucking rebuild it every 50,000 miles. Right. Like,
after, once you're in six digit mileage, your glather's so small because you, aren't fucking up your back pulling it in and out. Right. The shipping's lower when you're constantly having to get new ones sent to you. A lot of reasons to love these things.
I mean, apparently they are pretty easy to rebuild, but I'd rather not do that, honestly.
So, I actually find that surprising just because I would imagine that weird shapes like that would be hard.
I mean, you might need like some special tools or, it's not... If you've rebuilt piston engine cars, it's not going to translate, but like, from what I understand, you just take it apart, clean everything, put in new seals, put everything back together with plenty of oil or assembly lube or whatever on everything. And
okay, so it sounds like we're using the term rebuild real generously.
Yeah,
well, it's not like there's not that many parts to replace.
Yeah, there's no head gasket. Yeah,
there's not a lot of small parts.
Yeah. But some of the disadvantages, we already talked about some of these, but they're less thermodynamically efficient because instead of, a cylinder, you've got this weird kind of half moon chamber that has more surface area per volume than a piston engine. So you're getting more heat loss into the housing and the rotor. And that means that you're getting worse fuel mileage. Also, you're getting incomplete combustion because, little bits of fuel can hide out in the corners of that chamber and not burn completely. So you also get worse emissions. It burns oil, like I said.
Yeah, these things, as far as I know, were known for having dog shit gas mileage, being very unreliable, and burning a fuckload of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Like, pretty consistently.
Yeah, I feel like if I want that, I'll just buy Mopar.
There's I was just looking at the Wikipedia page, and there's like a whole section on like how to calculate the volume, and it has a whole lot of like math symbols that I haven't seen since college. Lots of Greek letters in there. So,
Jesus Christ.
If you want to figure that out, go ahead. I've got better things to do with my time. Let's see. So yeah, I mean, we covered everything else. They wear down quickly and they need rebuilds and stuff.
Plus, they're not great for torque.
Yeah.
They're good for horsepower because they can rev so high, but they are not good. They're not very torquey.
Yeah.
You're not going to, like, hit the gas pedal and have it put you back in your seat so much as it really has to build that power because it's just getting there by once it's spinning super fast. That's the only way for it to get there. It's not like it doesn't have a lot of, like, oomph to it just in actual power. It's just as the thing spins faster, you will have more power. That's it.
Right.
So, torque-wise, not great.
That intuitively makes sense to me, because torque is always, like, really effectively described as volumetric efficiency, and there's just simply, like, not even me shitting on this motor, just, it's not efficient in any way. All of its power is made by the fact that it's making multiple, like, combustion cycles per revolution, and it revs to high hell.
Right.
Yeah.
It's, but, like, a lack of compression and a lack of, like, efficient burn and just a million other things immediately tell me that it's not going to be torquey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets the high horsepower by wasting a lot of fuel and shit.
Right.
And a lot of heat and a lot of everything else. It's, like, it's just very wasteful.
Hate them.
So, back to the history of the engine. So, in 1963... the NSU company presented the NSU Spider. And excuse me, that was the first consumer vehicle with a rotary engine, which went on sale in 1964. And so various companies looked to license the design. So especially Mazda looked into this, you know, a lot. Their first was the Mazda Cosmo in 1967. And of course there was the RX-7 and the RX-8, and I think there was, like, RX-3 through 6 also, somewhere in there.
Yeah, there was a number of other little, like, sport coupes and stuff that had it, as far as I know, the precursors to the RX-7.
And then this is basically how Wankel made his money, is licensing out this design. So some of the other companies that looked into the Wankel engine and then abandoned it were Daimler-Benz, General Motors, Toyota, Yanmar Diesel Company, Alfa Romeo, Rolls-Royce, Porsche, Nissan, Suzuki, Ford, BSA, Yamaha, Kawasaki, American Motors, Citroen, Norton, and John Deere as well.
You know what? I got to admit, there's a few of those that surprised me that they passed on.
Yeah. So,
like, Alfa Romeo is always dying for, like, something super unreliable and, like, finicky, and I am shocked that they passed up this opportunity, actually.
Yeah. So
I'm surprised anything diesel adjacent ever even considered it.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'll get into it, but, like,
okay. Yeah.
There were, you know, a couple that actually got it to work. Sort of. It required some cheats and some tweaks and whatnot. But I just briefly, I'll say, like, I think GM at one point, considered using a Wankel for the, Corvette, you know, like, one of the prototypes they had was, like, a mid-engine Corvette with a Wankel, which...
I'm not going to lie, a part of me thinks that would have been kind of
right.
Cool.
And,
I thought I couldn't hate Corvettes more.
Also, the AMC Pacer was originally going to have a Wankel engine.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And they had to, like, redesign the whole engine bay to, like, make a straight six fit later on. And then also the Sachs company in Austria, I believe, made a few lawnmower and chainsaw engines that were rotaries.
Yeah, I'm almost surprised we didn't see more of that, actually. Because, yeah. Like, lawnmowers, they don't give a shit how efficient they are. Like, really, they don't care, so... I am surprised they weren't, like, little rotaries.
Yeah. And then Suzuki and Norton also made production motorcycles with the Wankel engine, but only for, like, a couple years. And then, like, yeah, fuck this shit.
I would be interested to see how a motorcycle works with a rotary. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, that seems like
I think that's why they quit making them. They just didn't work.
Yeah. I'd still be curious, but yeah, I figure they probably weren't successful.
Yeah. But like, it seems like it would be a better design for a motorcycle where you're not so worried about fuel mileage or, you know, long-term yeah. reliability or whatever. But
and the small size, yeah. I mean, would really... And that's why I think it would make actually be good for, like, lawnmowers and chainsaws and shit. I'm like, I don't know. If you could make it, like, a teeny tiny little mower, right. yeah, I could see some benefits
I
there.
Mean, I...
And you don't give a fuck if it uses two extra drops of fuel. Like, who cares?
Like, when I was at tech school learning machining, we had to do, like, a final project. And I considered doing a 50cc Wankel engine to put on a moped. Until I looked into it more, and I'm like, oh no, this is a terrible, like, this is beyond my expertise as a machinist and, you know, doing CAD work and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
But it would be cool. Like, I would like to have a rotary moped. That'd be kind of fun. Let's see, where was I? Okay, so I'm going to talk about some of the three different weird designs here that different companies came up with. And the first is Rolls-Royce. They began developing a lightweight military diesel Wankel engine for the Ministry of Defense in 1964. And the idea was they wanted, you know, a diesel engine for like tanks and armored personnel carriers that would be lighter and have higher power than equivalent, you know, piston engine, diesel engines around the same time. But they wanted it to burn diesel, I assume, because all the other tanks burned diesel at that time. But, you know, they were working against the, you know, problems of low compression with the Wankel engine design.
That's why I was saying I was surprised that any of the diesel companies fucked with this, because...
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's a low compression motor relative to gas, that's crazy for diesel.
Right.
Yeah.
And the way that they got around this is that they added a second rotary engine that fed the first one as a compressor, basically. So, and it turned basically into a two-stage motor because you have a large rotor at the bottom that feeds the smaller rotor on top with high pressure air, and then the exhaust from the smaller one feeds into the larger one to drive it also. So you are getting a little bit more energy out of that expanding gas with the bigger rotor there. So they did these in mostly in four rotor configurations. So they had two low pressure rotors and two high pressure rotors. And their prototype engine had a displacement of 6.5 liters and would produce around 350 horsepower and weighed 929 pounds. So,
okay, that's not great. Yeah,
well, I mean...
That's shockingly less than I would have thought.
So they compared this to diesel engines of the time. It had a decent power-to-weight ratio compared to other diesel engines.
Did it really?
So the issue is that you build a diesel engine for, like, bottom-end torque, which right. is obviously, as we discussed, not what this is for. Maybe, like, the turbo or the supercharged version operated more efficiently in that respect. But, yeah, like, this is in the 60s. This is regular GM big block numbers.
Right.
Like, 929 pounds would be heavy as fuck for a big block. 350 yeah. horsepower would be average for a 396. Like, literally, I think the earlier Chevy big block was a 396 or 398. I always mix it up. But, like, yeah, it was...
396, I think.
Yeah, I thought so. I mix it up. But, yeah, I think they were, like, you know, 325 to 350 horsepower.
Yeah.
And definitely, like, I think they would probably weigh around 600 pounds.
Yeah, and any...
Yeah, this seems crazy heavy yeah. and big. And, like, they're... It seems like they made a lot of mistakes here. I'm genuinely, like, I'm not, like, super pro-rotary, but, like, they seemed like they made a few errors. I'm genuinely confused as to how this is possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because they're normally... Like, the engines are normally fucking smaller. So if you made one bigger and also made shit power and no torque, I'm they went wrong somewhere.
Yeah, I feel like I just don't have enough information because you don't typically worry about the horsepower output of a diesel. Like, it is a way to measure power, but that's not where they shine.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, diesel engines, like, commercial diesel engines of that era and even now, yes, weigh thousands of pounds. Like,
yeah.
So, if it was making 350 horsepower diesel is a lot, but what you're not factoring in is the probably 2,500 pound-feet of torque that it's making. Like, because those things, like, don't even rev past, like, 1,800 RPMs hardly.
Right.
So we just, I feel like I don't have enough information to judge this accurately, but if I want to extrapolate, it sounds bad.
Do we know the kind of torque this thing made, or because I can't imagine it was a lot. It's usually less than the horsepower.
I don't have that figure, but I do have,
that means it was bad. Yeah. That's, I'm voting like that's not a good sign, because they would have been like, but wait, it made X amount of torque if it was good. So
yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it does say that the, it weighed about half as much as comparable piston engine diesel engines around the same time. But apparently they came into some financial difficulty around the Suez crisis around this time, and which I forget what year that was, but eventually the project was canceled in 1974. And
the- I think the takeaway here is that if this was like a good design for a diesel or even a gas motor, it would have probably gotten more traction.
Right. Well, and like some of the earlier prototypes, not this one that I'm talking about, the 2R6 is this prototype. Some of the earlier ones, they couldn't get them to run on their own. So they had to feed them heated and compressed gas or heated air to get it actually to ignite, because diesels need a certain amount of heat to actually ignite the fuel. So like that was kind of the, like this was the first one that they actually got to run on its own, you know, without feeding it pressurized air. Let's see. So I'm skipping a little around in time here, but in 1983, John Deere bought the rights from Curtiss Wright Aircraft Company to...
Oh, I used to make parts for them.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We got a Curtiss Wright here in town.
Interesting. They had the license from Wankel to you know, build rotary engines, but they hadn't really done much with it. So John Deere bought out those rights and, you know, their rotary power division and incorporated it into John Deere. And so they were also trying to make this work for diesel engines in military applications, but their difference was trying to make it an omnivorous engine, meaning it could burn, you know, multiple different kinds of fuel, including gasoline, diesel, kerosene, jet 5, jet 8, ethanol, natural gas. And
is there any engine that has ever been able to accomplish that?
So I think,
to your knowledge, because I don't think kerosene and diesel are pretty fucking different.
Yeah, I think there were some military diesel engines that, like, the U.S. Army used that could burn multiple fuels. Maybe not all of these different fuels. But,
I mean, that's shocking, though.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you put any kind of fuel that is, like, besides diesel, like, if you put gasoline into a diesel motor, you're fucked. It's going kaboom. Because it's super high compression.
Yeah.
There's just no... And kerosene's even worse, well, as far as I'm aware.
I think also diesel fuel acts as a lubricant to some degree, so that helps out.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're taking that away, it can fuck up your engine. But
that's why I'm just like, for a diesel engine to run on any of these other fuels, these like super volatile, you know, almost higher energy fuels, seems crazy to me. That's a big ask.
This is something I've never looked into, but I learned a long time ago, true or not, I'm not sure, that even diesel engines weren't intended to run on diesel. They were originally designed to run on vegetable oil.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this. We might have to do a more in-depth episode on Rudolph Diesel.
We definitely do.
he was an interesting guy, apparently. I forget which of you that was talking about him, but...
It was me, because a listener mentioned that, okay. Oh, did you know this guy's a socialist? And I was like, fucking no. yeah, I guess we do have to do an episode about that. Okay. So.
Oh, I'm going to tell so many right-wingers that now.
You having fun with your socialist engine over there?
There's got to be a play on words for, like, commie and Cummins in here somewhere. Like.
Oh, man. I saw a diesel truck with Alberta plates the other day driving like an absolute dick. Anyway, I don't know what it is about diesel engines that brings out the worst in people. Okay, where was I? So,
yeah, tell us about this John Deere.
Yeah, so the way that they got all these different fuels to work, they called it a SCORE engine, and that's an acronym for Stratified Charge Omnivorous Rotary Engine. And stratified charge means they basically had two injectors per rotor, and the first one would inject a small amount of fuel that would mix more thoroughly with the air. But it would be not able to ignite. It would be too lean of a mixture to ignite on its own. And then they would inject a much richer mixture right next to the spark plug that would ignite the larger charge of leaner mixture. And so they were still using spark plugs even with like diesel and kerosene and stuff. And apparently it worked pretty well. At least up to a point. So they built a few different prototypes of various sizes, but the model that was most successful was the SCORE 580, which was 5.8 liters per rotor. And they usually ran these as a two rotor, so 11.6 total displacement.
Nice.
And, you know, as we talked about, diesel engines tend to be heavy. This one was... almost 2,000 pounds. It was 1,895 pounds. So the first iteration produced over 500 horsepower at 3,600 RPM. So I guess we could do the math and figure out what that is in foot-pounds. Later prototypes made 750 naturally aspirated or 1,500 with a turbo. They also... made a prototype six rotor configuration that displaced 34.7 liters
and it weighed what 10,000 pounds? Like it weighed more than a Cybertruck?
It weighed 2.4 tons. So that's
that's a lot.
Around 5,000 pounds for this engine, but it made 3,000 horsepower. So they worked on a few different designs for this. They had a stationary engine that ran on natural gas, like for power generation, that they looked at. You know, again, they were trying to make this work for tanks and stuff, but they ran into all these problems and they decided it wasn't worth it. So in 1991, they sold the design to Rotary Power International, which is a company that formed to use this design for boats, so marine applications. And the idea would be that it would be a smaller package and lighter weight than an equivalent diesel engine, you know, and able to run on various fuels.
I did that math.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was making 730 pound-feet of torque.
With the 750 horsepower version, or what?
That was the 500 horsepower version, because
that
was the only one that it stated the RPM that it was making the power at.
Yeah.
Unless the other one was also making 750 at 3,600 RPMs, in which case I could do that real quick. But
it might have been.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty impressed either way.
Yeah. I am not impressed by 730 pound feet from a motor that sized.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess.
I have literally heard of a big block making more than that.
Right. Yeah.
Like, the big aftermarket, like, big block Chevy is 632, and I've seen those make over 800 pound-feet of torque.
Yeah. But for, like, a marine diesel engine, those are usually pretty detuned and made for, you know, reliability and all that, which I'm sure
yeah,
that was...
see that. Yeah, well, this you'd have to rebuild after every trip, but, you know, whatever.
You get three fish, and then you gotta rebuild the engine.
you gotta go out to sea with a spare.
So now we're moving on to the Soviet Union. So in 1974, Otto Vaz, aka Lada, began developing a single rotor engine, and they were using it for police pursuit vehicles. So basically, they wanted the
something that would never catch anybody. Makes sense.
Well, I mean, the regular Lada was not very powerful, so they wanted something that's just a little bit more powerful than a stock Lada that can outrun basically all other Soviet cars.
Yeah, do you remember our like Soviet racing series where we learned that like Formula Easter cars that were based around Lada engines were making like 200 horsepower?
Yeah, and like the basic one made like 60, I think.
I think 200 is me rounding up. I want to say it was actually like 150, 160.
Right. So they tried to get a licensing deal from Wankel and NSU, but they got turned down. So they're like, you know, we'll just develop our own, but we're going to like rely very heavily on the Mazda design as a, you know, reverse engineering kind of thing. So like, I don't know if any parts interchange between the Mazda and the Lada version, but they're very similar designs.
I mean, that was probably the smart way. The smart play was to, you know, develop it from the Mazda design, which was theoretically already better.
Right. And also, like, I support not giving money to Nazis. So, like, not paying that licensing fee, I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
The production version appeared in 1974 in a car known as the, or no, excuse me, the engine was called the VAZ-311. This was a 654 single rotor engine that developed 71 horsepower. So slightly more than the stock Lada. They are installed in the Lada Riva sedan, which was given the model name VAZ-21018.
That rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah. And they were distributed amongst police and some party officials for trials. They didn't do so good. Only one of the engines lasted longer than 6 months. And the average lifespan was around 12,000 miles.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Okay, not great.
I love to praise the Soviet Union every chance I get, but I'm sorry, the quality of goods they produced is not known to be one of their strong points.
Well, I mean, also just the inherent problems with this design did not...
I'm more commenting on stacking those two things.
Yeah.
When you combine inherent problems in a design and inherent problems in manufacturing, it's not a recipe for success. It's not a double negative making a positive here.
Right.
I would at least give them credit for like, okay, they tested it out they did some beta testing and then decided, oof, all right, this thing doesn't fucking work, before going all in on it. So
yeah,
credit where credit is due, I suppose.
Oh, and I think I forgot to mention this, but the previous one, the John Deere design that was bought out by the company to put in boats, that company went under in the 2000s sometime. Kind of hard to find when exactly they actually stopped, you know, any production or whatever, or research. I don't think they ever made it to production. I think it was all still research. But back to the Lada version, you know, they also noted that it was had very bad fuel mileage. So it wasn't necessarily good for like an everyday person's car. The next version came out in 1983, and this was a twin rotor 1.3 liter. And so they called that engine the VAZ-411. This one made between 115 and 140 horsepower, depending on the year and who you ask. And then this chassis was the VAZ-21019. This one was actually, you know, a lot more durable. And they were actually used in police cars and, you know, apparently did pretty well. They got the fuel mileage was twice as bad as the piston engine versions, though. So
Because it is Soviet, I would rather the phrasing half as good.
Yeah. Twice as worse, half as good. Yeah. So they were also used in 4x4 off-road racing buggies, which I couldn't find much more information on that, at least in English. I'll have a link in the description on a channel called Vizio Racer, who I think is from Slovenia, somewhere in the Eastern Bloc, who you know, has more access to like Russian language stuff and you know, has more details about this, but there's not a whole lot on the internet, at least that I could find. They also eventually produced a three-rotor prototype, or actually I think it did actually go into production, the VAZ 431, which made up to about 205 horsepower, but wasn't produced in very large numbers. And then this evolved eventually into the VAZ 513, which was a 1.9-liter three-rotor that made up to 280 horsepower.
Hell yeah. All right, that sounds great.
And this also wasn't produced in high numbers. It was put in limousines for party officials, also in helicopters and airplanes.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, helicopters are already scary enough. I don't know if I'd want to ride in one.
Yeah, like at least an airplane can coast when its motor blows up after the first 15 minutes of flight. But like right. A fucking helicopter, that's rough.
Yeah. So they actually kept making rotary engines through the 90s. They put these in a front-wheel drive car called the Lada Samara, a.k.a. the VAZ 2108 and 2109. And these got the 1.3-liter engine that made 140 horsepower, which their 0 to 60 mile-an-hour time was around 8 seconds, which was pretty good for the early 90s as far as an economy car. But these didn't get good mileage, so I don't know if you could call them an economy car. So reportedly there was a design proposal for a 4-rotor twin turbo engine for use in amphibious APCs and hovercraft and stuff like that, but it was never made. It would have made apparently 680 horsepower.
Oh man, I'm gonna start speculating on how much power things that I'm never gonna build would have made.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe they did a prototype. I don't know if they actually I don't think they ever produced any in any quantity though. But I think they did actually test it. So, I mean, in Russia today, like, these are still pretty popular engines for tuners, you know, for the same reason that the Mazda ones are. They rev high, they take boost pretty well. So there are, you know, videos of people street racing with these Ladas with the rotary engines out there. They sound pretty cool, I gotta say. And then the last you know, a little note I have is that sometime during the Soviet Union, they made a rotary engine for use on torpedoes, but it had instead of a three, you know, triangular rotor, it was a five-pointed star-shaped rotor in a four-lobed sort of four-leaf clover housing. And this was fueled by hydrogen peroxide, so kind of like similar to how, you know, some rockets are fueled, and supposedly made 979 horsepower. But I don't have,
respectable.
I don't have a displacement number on that one, so all I have is some very grainy photos. But yeah, that's all the engines I have for today. I guess listeners, write in if I missed any that you want me to talk about, any weird Wankel engines or, you know, weird applications for them, like the time that Mazda put one in a pickup truck, that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, we could talk about all the Mazda rotary engines, but I, you know, plenty of people have covered that before. We're out here talking about the weird ones.
I mean, I feel like I'm ignorant enough about the Mazda ones that like I could definitely learn something, but at the same time, you know, those are the ones that everybody knows about. So
yeah. That's kind of my
or that more people know about. It sucks that the concept was
bad from the beginning.
was put forward by a Nazi fuck. So that sucks. Right. But, you know, it's cool that it was improved upon by literally everyone else. So I guess there's a bright side there.
I will, for the record, say, if anyone listening is a particular fan of the Rotary Motors, I don't really hate them that much. It's just when I first got interested enough to learn anything about them, like, the drawbacks immediately were glaring because, you know, by that point, this is a 100-year-old fucking design. Like, so, you know, you don't know what you can do with something until you try. So, you know, yeah. Credit where credit is due, except for the Nazi. Fuck him. But the people who, like, tried to fix the mess that he cobbled together, you know, they were giving it an honest try, and it just doesn't work because it's a bad design. Sorry. If you want something that revs to 10,000 RPMs, then you can build a V8 that does that.
Yeah,
that's true. Won't sound the same.
Oh,
but,
no, and it will be so expensive to build.
I mean, so will a rotary.
Yeah, fair
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, trust me. So.
The most I saw an LS that was specifically built so the guy could quote unquote turn it up to 11, and it would rev past 11 grand. But I don't remember the numbers that he spent on building it, but it was fucking god awful.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I don't even know what it would take to make that. Just like, I mean, besides all forged parts, but like, what else can you do?
Because it's a LS is a pushrod motor. You have to do all sorts of valve train stuff.
Like, make it as light as possible.
Yeah, like, because, I mean, like...
Okay.
Yeah, that like, it's high... Like, as much as I love to praise pushrod engines and say, like, I don't really give a shit about overhead cams, like, when you want high revving like that, you really love overhead cams because that's rotating mass. Pushrods are reciprocating, which...
Yeah.
It creates a compounding effect at higher RPMs like that where it gets harder and harder to, like, make it work the way you want it to. It's entirely doable, but it just takes money.
Yeah, makes sense.
Of course, I had to make this a V8.
Oh, yeah, no. That's what you're here for, right?
Yeah.
Any other thoughts before we wrap up here, guys?
I'm just glad the Soviet Union took this and ran. Especially knowing that they didn't get the fucking rights to it. They were just like, fuck you.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes fucking around and finding out is kind of fun, you know?
Intellectual property is a mixed bag, but I mostly just say steal everything.
Yeah.
So, good on you, Soviet Union. You stole while the stealing was good.
Yeah. I mean, I'll advocate piracy, especially if the intellectual property is owned by someone terrible. Then
yeah.
Then it's...
Yeah, especially then.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. I guess...
Well, thanks for listening.
Yeah. Check out our social media and all that. Send us an email.
Yeah, we got email, we got social medias, follow us there, we post memes and stuff. The algorithm has not been favoring us lately. It is a dying, like, medium, because we don't want to make TikTok videos. I'm not good at that, and I'm like, alright, well, if that's what the algorithm wants, fuck it.
I don't feel like anyone I have talked to in the last several months has felt like the algorithm was favoring them. I don't even know what is out there right now.
Yeah, it's weirdly all about the, like, TikTok-style videos, and I'm just like, yeah.
The internet is dying, and a new world is struggling to be born.
Yes. But hey, you know, we still post memes while the ship is sinking. We're posting memes every once in a while, so
yeah.
Go follow us. I guess we're on, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Hexbear, Facebook, you know, all the usuals. So check that out. Email us if you have questions, want us to cover a topic, or you have comments, whatever. We're happy to hear from listeners. Yep. So
carsandcomrades@gmail.com, carsandcomrades most everywhere else.
Yeah.
You can Google it, find it.
There's no one else using that name, I promise you.
It has taken us four times as long to promote our social media as it needs to.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Good show, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Capitalism works, if it works at all, because it always has socialism to bail it out and to...
and subsidize it.
Ask any racer, any real racer.
It don't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning's winning.
In the 1980s, 50 corporations controlled most news media in America. By 1992, that number shrunk to 24. And today, only 6 corporations control 90% of everything Americans see, hear, and read. The money spent on the Iraq War alone, which killed 1 million people, 5% of Iraq's entire population, and planted the seeds for ISIS to flourish, could have covered all global investments to halt climate change trends.